is a very large university in pretty much the center of the United States. It's about 200 kilometers south of Chicago. And I also affiliate with our regional hospital. So I kind of have an academic affiliation as well as a medical affiliation. And there's an aerial view of my campus. So what I'm going to do is, as the title indicates here, I just want to provide a rather broad overview of cleft lip and palate care in the United States. So unlike Dr. Hathaway's excellent talk, I'm not going to get into a lot of detail. But I just want to kind of give you a sort of a flavor of the kind of care that's available in the United States. And we might start with knowing something about the number of people in the United States. Currently, the population of the U.S. is about 317 million. And a few years ago, I participated in a conference at our Center for Disease Control, CDC. So we kind of compiled our data and decided that the incidence of clefting is about one in roughly 600 live births. We'll see different numbers there depending on the author, depending on the study, depending on the country, etc. But just to use that as sort of an index. And if you look at the numbers, we're talking about maybe over half a million people in the United States with cleft. Now, thinking worldwide, if we consider countries with very large populations like China with 1.3 billion people and India with 1 billion people, the numbers are staggering, you know, so there's a big, big need worldwide for cleft care. In the United States, we have a large number of teams. In fact, we have exactly 161 teams that are approved and listed in the directory of the American Cleft Palate Craniofacial Association. And I'm getting to know a lot of these teams because I've been on the commission for approval of cleft palate teams now for a number of years, and I currently chair that commission. So what we do is we have applications for approval, and then we evaluate these applications in relation to six standards that ACPA has developed. And I'm not going to go into the details of those standards at all this morning. If people have questions about that, I'd be happy to address them. I think I'm getting some feedback here. I don't know. I don't know exactly what to do there. Let's see. Maybe that's a little bit better.
That's good.
Is that better? Okay, very good. So this year we are considering having international approval and recognition of teams. And again, if you are interested in something like that, I'd be happy to talk to you about it later. There are 50 states in the United States, and only 5 of the 50 states do not have a team listed for their state. So in other words, 45 teams have, or states have teams listed. The number of teams per state ranges considerably, and this is pretty much related to the population of each state. So California, which is a very large state, has the most teams listed, and that's 20. Several states have only one team listed. And I know that in the UK there were many teams there, and that those have been consolidated. And I think that in some ways that's a good thing, because as Dr. Hathaway was talking, what that does then is it enables people to have larger numbers of cleft palate individuals to work with. Sometimes if you have too many teams, each team might see only a relatively few number of cases per year, and that's not necessarily a good thing. But that's why the ACPA wants to have standards, so that if a team is recognized as a bona fide official team, that they must abide by some standards. Okay, so you know, there are good things and there are not so good things about having lots and lots of teams. For years and years, we've defined a team as having at least three specialists: a surgeon, a dental specialist, specifically an orthodontist, and a speech-language pathologist. And in parentheses here, I'm referring to that as a speech therapist. And as Dr. Summerland already pointed out, what people are called sometimes differs a little bit depending on the country. In the UK, they're called speech therapists. In the United States, they're called speech-language pathologists. But they basically have the same training. So we're not going to get too hung up on nomenclature. Now, every team in the United States must have at least those three disciplines. But in reality, many of the teams, especially the larger hospitals, larger university settings, etc., have many, many more professionals on their team. And I'm not going to go through the whole list here, but some of these are quite obvious. Okay. Now, the parent organization in our country is called the American Cleft Palate Craniofacial Association. Some years ago, it was called only the American Cleft Palate Association, but the term craniofacial was added because some of our centers deal not only with cleft lip and palate, but also with craniofacial anomalies. And we define craniofacial by transcranial surgery. If the brain case is entered, that's how we define craniofacial. Now, if one is considering, you know, Lafort 1, Lafort 2, Lafort 3, Lafort 1 and 2, I won't go into the details, but are really kind of maxillofacial procedures. Lafort 3 is maybe a little bit borderline in terms of how we would, you know, deal with that team as a craniofacial, for example. And those are kind of some of the issues that we're dealing with this calendar year. We're trying to maybe kind of be more specific in how we're defining terms, and that certainly is one of them. The ACPA has roughly 2,500 members. That kind of varies a bit depending on the year, but we've been around 2,500 or so, maybe a little bit more, for quite a while now. The major publication of the ACPA is the Cleft Palate Craniofacial Journal. And here again, for many years it was called the Cleft Palate Journal, and the term craniofacial was added when the name of the association was changed to include craniofacial. We consider the Cleft Palate Journal as an international, interdisciplinary clinical and research journal because there are many different areas of investigation and clinical work that are published in the journal. And many of our submissions are from countries outside of the United States and Canada. A couple of years ago, it was 75% of the submissions were actually from outside of the USA and Canada. That figure might be a little different, I don't know, but it's probably roughly that, maybe even a little bit more now. So what I want to do now is to talk about some of the major areas that we recognize and we investigate and we do clinical work that tend to get published in our journal as well as presented at our annual meetings. And we just had an annual meeting of the ACPA in March, and Dr. Hathaway was one of the leaders in organizing that meeting and so forth. That's where he is located, in Indianapolis, which is not too far from Chicago. So one of these areas of investigation and clinical kinds of activities involve the psychosocial aspects of cleft lip and palate and craniofacial anomalies. And again, I'm not going to go into the details of this literature at all. We could spend days on just this aspect. So I'm trying to kind of capture some of the broader thinking in these areas. And Kathy Kapp-Simon, Dr. Kapp-Simon, has been a leader in psychosocial aspects for many, many years. And She has published a lot of work with her collaborators. And again, the broad stroke here is that the majority of children with cleft function pretty well in a manner typical of children of their age. Okay, so we typically don't have major problems with language. And most of what I'm going to be talking about now involve children and adults to some degree with cleft lip and or cleft palate. I'm not going to really get into craniofacial anomalies. That adds a layer of complexity that I don't really have time to get into right now. So here basically we're talking mostly about children born with cleft lip or cleft lip and cleft palate. Now, there is some evidence, however, that there may be a few more children than would be expected who demonstrate cognitive, behavioral, and emotional difficulties that are of clinical concern. That's why this is an ongoing area of investigation. So we consider that psychologists are really important people that contribute to teams. Many teams have a psychologist who sits around the table when we evaluate and discuss our patients, but we must have at least a psychologist in the hospital or the community to whom we can refer patients if and when necessary. Well, just about every one of these slides, I could say that more research is needed. My former professor at the University of Illinois was charged one time to decide how much research do we need in the area of speech disorders, and I think his conclusion was an infinite amount. In other words, we never have enough research, and I think Dr. Hathaway made that pretty clear. You know, we've got a long way to go. There's a lot to learn, and even though I've been in this area for over 40 years, I'm still learning new things, and that's the way I want it to be. I never want to stop learning. All right, and here we go. There's a lot of controversy here about virtually everything that deals with surgery, you know, Dr. Summerlad did a really nice job of showing us, I think, the pathway to different kinds of surgery. And so lip surgery possibly is one of the more consistent ones because I think a lot of surgeons do, in fact, repair the lip at about 3 months of age. And we certainly do that in our center. And a lot of teams, maybe most teams, use what we call the Millard rotation advancement. And here again, I'm certainly not going to pretend that I'm an expert in surgery, so again, I'm not going to go into details here. We already heard from Dr. Hathaway about the gingival perioscopioplasty. The GPP is quite controversial, and as those beautiful data start to emerge and we start to see a pattern, we may change things. And that's, again, the right thing to do. We have to make sure that what we're doing is the right thing. And one way to do that, of course, is to pool our knowledge and to pool our data. The NAM, nasolabial molding, is generally done in conjunction with GPP, and both of these together are rather controversial. Palate surgery, my goodness. Again, as Dr. Hathaway pointed out in the Eurocliff study, the types of surgery are kind of like fingerprints, you know. No two seem to be alike. And in talking to Dr. Summerlad yesterday, we have to be careful when we use a label like Heinz palatoplasty. Well, what does that really mean? You know, and when people conceive of Heinz, and we had this discussion yesterday, that what we're calling Heinz may not necessarily be what Heinz described, you know. So these terms sometimes tend to latch on to a sort of procedure that's in the ballpark, but people have their own variations sometimes. So we have to be very careful when we're using labels to describe what we do surgically. But anyway, there's pretty good consistency, at least in the United States, about the age of primary palatoplasty. In other words, the initial surgery that's done. And that typically is done when the child is about 9 to 12 months. In our center, we aim for 9 months. And we saw yesterday that a lot of the patients here, a lot of the children, did in fact receive some of their initial palate surgery during the first year of life. Now, the type of surgery, of course, is going to matter too. It's not only when you do the surgery, but what type you're doing, and also, frankly, the skill of the surgeon. You know, that should go without saying. Somebody who is as skillful and experienced as Dr. Sommerlad, we would expect him to have excellent results, and he does. And, you know, we're not here to judge anybody, you know, but I think we can learn from each other. And what we can learn from Dr. Sommerlad, I think, will benefit all of us, really. And in the States, we typically do one-stage surgeries. In other words, the hard and soft palate are repaired in a single operation. That certainly has not been true necessarily of all centers, especially some in Europe. Again, we're talking about different types. I'm not going to go into the details of surgery here, but these three, at least by name, and remember what I just said, you know, there are different variations on these, no matter what you call them. You have been described as V to Y retroposition, von Langenbeck, and the furlough. The furlough is used quite a bit in the States. And our colleague Leonard Furlough, he attends all of our meetings, of the ACPA, and he comes to a lot of speech sessions too. So he's very interested in what we're doing in terms of speech, and he's gotten to be a pretty good friend of mine over the years. And all right, so what else do we do surgically? Well, again, here's a list that I'm not going to go into details about. Alveolar bone grafting. We've already heard from Dr. Hathaway that secondary is preferred over primary. The term secondary here, I think, is used more in relation to age than you know what you do initially. So maybe that's not necessarily a good term. But that type of alveolar bone grafting surgery is typically done when the child is about 8 or 9 years. That's what we do in our center. Here we go. Orthognathic surgery for mid-face advancement. Many of our patients require mid-face advancement. And this is where we really can benefit from a team. Because, you know, if you're going to advance the mid-face, the maxillary segments, etc., what does that do to other things like speech? Okay, so we always have to be cognizant of treatment that might be good for one area may not necessarily be good for another. And we want to kind of keep that balance. If one treatment is very good, but it lowers something else, maybe we need to reinvestigate that. Maybe we have to change this procedure or maybe back off of it, you know. And so the area of cleft is very exciting because it's complicated. There are all of these variables, you know. And again, even though I've been in this profession for 40 years, you know, what we used to do 40 years ago, we certainly don't necessarily do now, okay. In our own center, we like to wait for skeletal maturity. It's a little bit earlier in girls than it is in boys, but, you know, roughly around 15 years or so. Distraction osteogenesis, you know, some of these things, again, are rather controversial. Lip and nasal construction is usually required. Different procedures, again. So these are some of the common other surgeries that have been reported in the literature, but we still need to kind of get more information, more research needs to be done. Dental management. These are the two broad categories in dental management that are very important in the area of cleft, one of which is orthodontia. I don't have to go on and on about that. We've talked about that a lot. Same thing with prostodontia. Now, with prostodontia, you know, what are we talking about here? Feeding plates, obturators, speech bulbs. We don't really, feeding plates are not very common in the States. And I don't want to, you know, talk out of turn here either, because some centers use more in the area of prosthetics than other centers. And I think one of the deficiencies we have, frankly, in the United States is that we don't have enough prosthodontists. We don't really have a prosthodontist on my own team in Central Illinois. We refer to a prosthodontist in Chicago, for example. You know, speech bulbs, over the years, people have tried to reduce the... Let me rephrase that and say, try to increase the movement of the soft palate by making a speech bulb smaller. So the idea here is to put a speech bulb posterior to the soft palate and gradually reduce the size of that bulb, theoretically, kind of encouraging, so to speak, the soft palate from moving more and more and more. The evidence there is a little bit borderline. I think that, along with Dr. Hathaway, if every center were doing this, we'd have a larger database from which to draw. We just don't. And so that's one of those things I think we have a bit of a limitation in the United States. My colleague and friend, Tachimura, from Japan, from Osaka. In Japan, they use a lot of appliances. It's very common to use appliances. And he uses a palatal lift to maybe help stimulate the soft palate prior to surgical management, if that's necessary in children at a later age, for VPI. The idea there is that they're not necessarily going to use a palatal lift forever, but rather to has a sort of a precursor to perhaps make surgery a little bit easier, maybe even a different type of surgery. I can tell you that in the United States, palatal lifts are very common for people who have neurologic impairments. So if there's an adynamic palate, for example, that's clearly related to a neurologic impairment, then a palatal lift is very common, so that it physically lifts the soft palate into a more favorable position to reduce hypernasality. Hearing management. Okay, we saw yesterday a patient who had a hearing loss. We have very aggressive management for hearing loss because virtually every baby who's born with a cleft has otitis media with effusion. In other words, there's a problem with middle ear fluid. It's virtually universal in the cleft population. So we're very aggressive in the States and other places about managing that situation. Now, in relation to a conductive hearing loss, that's what we call it if there's fluid in the middle ear, it typically does not persist. And the good news is that Usually, middle ear problems resolve by the time the child is about 6 years of age or older. And the good news is that we typically don't have long-term hearing loss with our patients. And we do treat them aggressively, though, and we typically treat them with a meringotomy and pressure equalizing tubes that are placed right in the eardrum to aerate the middle ear, and I think in the UK these are referred to as grommets. And this is often performed when the child is put to sleep, general anesthesia, and it's done simultaneously, and maybe with lip repair or maybe the primary palatoplasty a bit later. Language studies. A lot of our speech language people focus on language. The studies vary here. And the problem here is that it's a very heterogeneous population. Many, many things can have an impact on language. And what I'm talking about here is symbolization. When we want to express something in words, we have to have a representation of whatever it is we're trying to express, whether it's an animal or an action or whatever. So that's symbolization, that's language. The actual realization of that is speech, what we do with our speech organs and so forth. So we do make that differentiation. But what can impact language? Many things. If a person has a hearing loss, the information that is brought in to that person's brain and so forth can vary. VPI can have an effect on how we express that which we're trying to express. And the list goes on and on. I don't want to belabor the point here. Receptive language, you know, how we understand things tends to be pretty comparable to the normal control groups. So that when we evaluate our patients at a very young age, we do a language study, and they're pretty good at understanding things, okay? But when they try to express themselves, when babies try to express themselves, then the language development can differ a little bit, you know? And so they may be limited in terms of how they can express language verbally, okay? And then if one is limited in expression, you know, in the ability to express what they're trying to express, that can have effect on language in general in terms of their language expression. Well, how do we manage, well, how do we treat language disorders, if indeed there are any? This is pretty much the same as we would treat language impairment for any child, or any adult for that matter. Most of what I'm talking about here today relates to our child population. But so language therapy is pretty much the same as we would treat any other person who has a language disorder. And any differences that we see in a young age tend to diminish as the child grows older. Okay, that's the good news. All right, speech management. What do we do here? So we first have to identify the type of speech problem. And this is where I think teams must have a good speech pathologist, a good therapist. I'll tell you, I have personally experienced situations in which I was sitting around the table, you know, discussing patients that I saw, and I don't want to pick on surgeons, you know, but I'm going to in this case, because it's not only surgeons, it could be somebody else as well. But in my own experience, the surgeon said, well, you know, we need to do a pharyngeal flap, you know, for this child. I said, wait a minute, you know, there's nothing wrong with the velopharyngeal mechanism. What's going wrong here is the articulation. This child has an articulation problem. So we first have to identify what type of speech problem we're dealing with. And is it an articulation problem? If so, is there a physical problem? We saw yesterday a child who had a supernumerary tooth and a very low bulked flap, a fan flap, etc. And so there are things that we can do surgically and with our dental colleagues to try to overcome the physical problem. Obviously, if dentition is involved, if the teeth are rotated, if we have big missing spaces because of lack of dentition, then you know we need to treat those either with rather standard orthodontia, possibly prosthetics, and so forth. Now, we can have an articulation problem that's related to a physical problem, but we could also have one where you do an oral exam, as Dr. Summerlad said, there's nothing wrong. I don't see anything wrong. The teeth are fine, the tongue is fine, etc. Soft palate is fine, but there's still a speech problem. We would tend to call this a phonological problem. What that means is that there's something wrong with the patterning, you know. Somehow there just wasn't the right programming. The brain was not programming properly. And that, again, you know, requires speech therapy. But no amount of physical management is going to correct that. We have to work on changing the code, the pattern that is sent from the brain to the speech structures. And we call that a phonological problem. Resonance. Resonance here is kind of a broad term. And, you know, I have some knowledge about physics and acoustics and so forth. And, you know, some of these terms that are used in speech, turbulence comes to mind too. Our physicist colleagues would say, huh? You know, but these terms kind of stick, and the term resonance is usually used in relation to either hypernasality or hyponasality. So we use the term resonance usually to characterize those two aspects. Hyper, too much nasality, or hypo, too little nasality. Do you need to differentiate between those two? Absolutely. And when we talk to parents, oftentimes parents will say, well, my child is nasal. And then we say, what does that mean? You know, because sometimes nasal means either there's too much nasality, you know, that can be hypernasality, or the flip side of that is hypo, too little nasality. My mom is here today. I cannot simulate hyponasality short of doing what I did or putting, you know, some obstruction in my nose, which is an important point because there are some many things we can do to alleviate, to reduce hypernasality. I'll get into the therapeutic aspects a little bit later. But we cannot, no matter what we do in therapy, we cannot reduce hyponasality. That's a physical problem. So there might be an enlarged turbinate, you know, that requires turbinectomy. The blockage might be posterior. Maybe the flap, pharyngeal flap, is too wide. You know, so we have to identify what the problem is and treat it physically if we're talking about hyponasality. But clearly, we have to make a differentiation. You know, is it too much nasality or too little? Voice. The term voice, and my speech pathology colleagues get really upset if we refer to hypernasality as a voice problem. You know, they get upset because that term has sort of been associated with a laryngeal problem, okay? And there are many experts, even in my own department in speech, who specialize in laryngeal problems. There can be a voice problem, a laryngeal problem in children who are born with cleft, but that's a whole big area, you know, that we have to deal with as well. And a lot of times we work with our colleagues who are expert in voice and laryngeal disorders, including our laryngologists as well as speech pathologists who specialize in that. Okay, again, you know, if a physical problem is identified that's related to speech articulation, we got to do something about it, you know, physically. But if there's not an obvious physical problem, we need to deal with that then in terms of therapy. Oh boy, here we go. Fistula management. If we see a fistula, it doesn't necessarily mean that it is what I often call communicating. That is to say, there's not necessarily a joining between the oral cavity and the nasal cavities. Sometimes what we see is maybe a cone-shaped fistula where, you know, we look in the oral cavity and it looks like it might be fairly sizable, not something that's really obvious, but something that maybe looks like this. And we say, well, I'm not quite sure if it's communicating. You know, maybe food will get stuck up there and stuff like that. But from a speech standpoint, if it's not communicating, it's not a big problem. You know, how do we identify that? I think I'm going to get into more of this when I meet with the speech people. I have some simple screening procedures that I use to determine if it's communicating or not. Some of the obvious things that we can do is to plug it with some kind of substance. I like to use dental wax. Chewing gum, you know, it doesn't really work so well as we saw yesterday. So, but again, this is a whole area that would require some time for me to get into that. But it's important from a speech standpoint to identify if it's communicating. We saw some really big fistulae yesterday, and that's really obvious. I mean, if you could literally look through the fistula to see the oral or the nasal passages, then that's a big, big fistula. Is it going to have an impact on speech? Yes, indeed. You know, especially if it's that big, and the location makes a difference too. And even the definition here: are you going to call an alveolar space? Is that a fistula? I don't know. But if it's posterior to the dentition, and certainly if it's at the junction between the hard and the soft palate, we would definitely call that a fistula. Ideally, we would like to close a fistula surgically, ideally. And that's where we need our collaboration with our surgeons. You know, I would say, Dr. Summerland, can you do this? You know, I did my job. And yeah, there's a fistula there. Now, can you do your job and close that surgically, or do we have to do it some other way, like using prosthetics? And we saw an example of that yesterday in the 30-year-old patient. I'm going to skip this because this gets more into laryngeal kinds of treatment. I already talked about hyponasal management. We've got to find the obstruction, identify where it is, and then do something about it, either removing it or you know, some other sort of management. Dr. Summerlett was talking about this before. Hypernasality is perceived on vowels, on vocalic elements, especially the high vowels such as E and U. That involves a lot of high vowels, both E and U, and that's a phrase that I use a lot. I think you may have seen yesterday that if that is the only phrase that I can get the child to produce, so be it, and that gives me a lot of information. Nasal air emission, with or without turbulence, this is more, I'm going to get into this more with our speech people, nasal air emission occurs on consonants, especially what we call pressure consonants, those being the stops, the fricatives, and the affricates. And I think I demonstrated this maybe, you know, if the word I like to use for our American children is puppy, because they all know what a puppy is, right? And puppy gives a tremendous amount of information in terms of the integrity of the velofrontal cord. So I use the simple mirror test where I put the mirror under the nose and ask the child to say, "Puffy," and "Puffy," like that. And if he says it like that or she, it's going to fog the mirror. If he or she says puppy, the air is coming out the mouth and everything is fine. I'm being a little quick on all this stuff. If nasal air emission is identified, it's critical to identify whether it is what we call phoneme-specific nasal emission of air, or if it's more pervasive. If nasal emission air is pervasive and it occurs on virtually all pressure consonants, then we've got a physical problem that we have to deal with. But if it only occurs on certain sounds, usually on what we call the sibilants, like an S sound, if it only occurs on certain sounds, but it does not occur on other sounds, if the child says, "Hmph," like that, but he can say "puppy" very clearly, that would indicate, or at least suggest, that what we have here is a phoneme-specific problem. And that definitely does not require surgery and should not involve surgery. Instead, this is a treatment that is done therapeutically by a speech therapist, and it's relatively easy to correct this. What we do here is to prolong a T sound, because a lot of the people that have this problem can say a good T sound, so two, and so we will then sustain the T sound, two, 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 and it eventually becomes an S. We often use this procedure to generalize. If a child can produce one sound, we tend to use that sound and then generalize from that to a defective sound. And this is something that speech pathologists know very well. This is something they do all the time. But they would do that with general articulation problems, but not necessarily with phoneme specific. They need to be informed. And for you people out there that are speech people, you really, really have to be aware of this, okay? Because you're the ones that are going to be responsible for this. And if you're patients are getting surgical treatment for this, it's not right. It's wrong. All right, I just talked about that. All right. Let's see, how are we doing here for time? I think I'm going to kind of move along a little bit more quickly, because some of these things I'm going to be talking about with the speech people later. Dr. Summerlett talked a lot about this, about treatment for VPI. We don't use a one-size-fits-all, and I'm going to probably have to modify this slide, because I need to talk to Dr. Summerlett more. I've got to calibrate myself in terms of what we're really talking about here. I know what our own surgeons do when we call this sphincter pharyngoplasty, but I'm not exactly sure we're all using this term in the same way, and so I need to calibrate myself, and I think we need to do a better job, Brian, you know, of calibrating other people too. What are we talking about here? Because it's really important. If people are not using superiorly based flaps, and we don't use it for every patient, in fact, if there's not as big a problem, hypernasality is not as severe, we're more likely to use a sphincter pharyngoplasty, but we need to come to grips with what we're actually doing and what we're calling these things. And of course, Dr. Summerlad is the person who has advocated for palate re-repair, and so he is the person that we need to consult with when we're talking about palate re-repair. Pharyngeal augmentation. I just want to add to what Dr. Summerlad said. There's a long, long history in pharyngeal augmentation. That is trying to, if the palate, soft palate, is not moving as far, then how can we bring the posterior pharyngeal wall, and maybe even the circumference of the pharyngeal wall, how can we bring that forward? And many, many substances have been placed in or injected into the posterior pharyngeal wall. Typically, there are two things that are a problem here. If whatever is injected is sort of liquid, you know, it's not a solid, in other words, it tends to dissipate. There's no natural pocket in the posterior pharyngeal wall to hold that injection in place. So what happens is it just dissolves. Well, it dissipates, okay? And where it goes from there is another story, you know. If it's going to enter the bloodstream, et cetera, that's not a good thing. And I was horrified to hear your story about the fat injection. So the problem with anything that's injected, it dissipates. The problem with a more solid substance like proplast or, you know, cartilage or whatever you can think of to celastic pillows to, you know, make an incision and place in there, they tend to extrude, you know, and that's not good. You know, they tend to pop out of there. They don't stay in there very long. So this has not been an area that's been very successful over the years to try to augment the posterior pharyngeal wall. I like the idea of trying to augment the pharyngeal wall surgically, you know. I mean, it makes sense to increase the bulk of the posterior pharyngeal wall, but better to use the body's own material, so to speak, and not try to use foreign substances. I'm going to kind of switch over very quickly and to another set of slides. And there are more slides here that I don't have time really to go into all of these. All right, in our own center, we tend to use video nasal endoscopy first. That's our first choice. But as Dr. Summerlad so nicely pointed out, of the advantages and disadvantages, you know, we do in fact use video fluorography, lateral view, pretty regularly actually, because of the reasons that Dr. Summerlad mentioned. But sometimes we can get by, maybe that's not the way of putting it, but sometimes all we need is a video nasal endoscopy. Okay? You know, and he already talked about the advantages and disadvantages. We do not use barium in our lateral views. Occasionally we will use frontal views, in which case we have to use barium. Because if you're using a frontal view video fluorography, it's very difficult to visualize the lateral pharyngeal walls. So we will use barium to visualize the lateral pharyngeal wall movement. We don't do that too often because, again, as Dr. Summerlad said, there are problems in interpretation. What I've seen occasionally is that from other people's studies, and it kind of said me, it warned me, wait a minute, you know, be careful how you're interpreting these, that if you instill barium in the nasal passage and look at lateral pharyngeal wall movement, you can see a relatively sharp inward displacement. And what you're looking at here, I think, is the pooling of the barium on top of the velum. And as the barium elevates, it's actually what you're looking at is the pooling, a pool of barium on each side, which looks like a coming to a point, you know. And I know something about the anatomy of the region there. And I saw one of those x-rays at a professional meeting once, and I said, I don't think so. Lateral pharyngeal wall doesn't come to a point. So we don't really do that very often. We make much better use out of nasendoscopies. Other diagnostic instrumentation, I may get into this more with the speech group. Nasometry and aerodynamics. You know, as I mentioned in relation to Dr. Sommerlad's question, we do have all of these things available to us. But with regard to nasometry, this is fairly commonly available. It's not terribly expensive. But I, you know, when we look at so-called nasalance scores, which, all right, there's a partition here that's placed right under the nose, and there's a microphone above the partition, and there's a microphone below the partition. And each microphone picks up different acoustic outputs. But there is a bit of a crosstalk, and I'm not going to get into all of that. And one gets a score, okay, a nasalance score. And let's say you have a nasalance score of 50. What I kind of describe these scores as a fuzzy ruler, okay? You know, if you've got a score of 50 or 60 or 70, that's quite hypernasal. But as Dr. Sommerlad pointed out, we already know that. You know, we can hear that, you know, so it's an adjunct. We, you know, it supports us. If we want to document things, one thing that's it's useful, though, is to have a record of the progression of improvement or the decrease in hypernasality. We published a case like that, which was really a very nice record, because over the months, she had a neurologic impairment, and we had beautiful records and showed a graph in which her hypernasality started out very, very high, and then gradually over 15 months, okay, she came down into the normal range. And I often use that study to indicate that if there's a neurologic impairment, it may take a long, long time for nature to take its course and have some regeneration of the peripheral nerves. So, okay, and yeah, here's some. I've done a lot of MRI, as Dr. Sommerlad pointed out. I've been doing this for a long time now, and some of my former students are sort of taking over the baton and running with it. My former student and now colleague, Jamie Perry, has done a lot of work in this area. I had the good fortune originally, when I started doing MRI in relation to velopharyngeal kinds of things, to work with Paul Lauterbur. Paul Lauterbur won a Nobel Prize for his pioneering work in MRI, and I had the very good fortune of working with Professor Lauterbur on my campus. So, you know, talk about a good teacher. You know, it's good to pair up with a Nobel laureate. I'm going to kind of skip through these very quickly. Right now, this is a somewhat older slide now. What we're doing is we're acquiring data en bloc. We're acquiring 3D blocks of data from our MRI imaging. But this one, I think, shows very nicely that one of our first applications here is that we would take sections. And here you can see our sectioning through the soft palate. And here's the anterior nasal spine. This is a normal individual, by the way. And here's the tip of the uvula. And so what you're going to see next is what we call an oblique coronal plane, pretty much in the middle of the soft palate. This is and I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I could spend a lot of time on the anatomy here, but I'm not going to do that. I don't have time, but let me just point out here something, that this is a lot of fatty tissue in the anterior portion of the soft palate. And we're able, really, we've improved our resolution to the point where we can literally identify the musculus uvulae in cross-section. But let's take a look here. This is what I call an oblique coronal MRI. And this is a cut through the head like this, right? And it is along the plane of the levator muscle. And we know in the normal individual that the levator, the origin of the levator, is at the base of the skull, and it forms a sling with its partner from the opposite side. Both bundles come into the middle of the velum. Here's the middle of the velum. This is the oral opening, and this is the nasopharyngeal opening. And then when the muscle contracts, it pulls the velum up and back to make contact, hopefully, with the posterior pharyngeal wall. Now, we're continuing to improve our technology, and I'm very fortunate to be involved with a very strong bioengineering program on our campus, and I'm fortunate to work with people who are experts in this area, and we're pushing the envelope. We actually have frame rates now of 100 frames per second, which is really, really fast, without necessarily overcoming quality. And there are many tricks that can be used, because when you image using MRI, you wind up with a set of numbers, you know, and you can do a lot of, manipulation with those numbers. You can delete a lot of stuff that you're not interested in, etc. I don't know how much time I've got left here, probably I'm winding down, but this is an axial view. We don't always do only coronal leaks, but this is an axial view, so it's a cut through the head like this, and we see the levator muscle advancing forward and contacting the hard palate in this region here. And here's one. Here's an axial MRI, in which the levator fibers are crossing the midline. There's a little bit of a deficiency here, and we found that with some mucous cleft palate, it may be what we call occult, meaning that it's not that obvious. You may not see the typical triad in a submucous cleft, but it's more subtle. And that's where MRI, I think, is very, very helpful. We saw a patient yesterday in which I mentioned that I think maybe we would do an MRI on that individual to actually view the muscles. And MRI is the only procedure right now where we can...